New Thinking Aloud is presented by the California Institute for Human Science, Mind, Body, Spirit University, a leader in fully accredited in-person and online U.S. college degree programs in the topics we cover here. Visit their website at cihs.edu.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlov.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlov. Today we'll be exploring the topic of gods, egregores, and archetypes. My guest is Ronnie Pontiac, who worked as Manly P. Hall's research assistant, screener, and designated substitute lecturer for 7 years. He has produced award-winning documentaries and has written articles for various esoteric magazines. He is author of American Metaphysical Religion, Esoteric and Mystical Traditions of the New World. He is co-author with Tamra Lucid of The Magic of the Orphic Hymns, a new translation for the modern mystic. He's been interviewed on New Thinking Aloud many times, and our previous interview was about the return and manifestations in contemporary times of the ancient Egyptian goddess, the lion goddess Sekhmet. And if you haven't watched that video, I'm going to link to it in the upper right-hand corner of your screen. If you have a computer that can capture that link, I would encourage you to view that video because it will be very relevant for today's discussion. Ronnie lives in Los Angeles, and now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Ronnie. It's a pleasure to be with you once again.
It's always a delight and an honor to be with you, Jeffrey.
Well, thank you. We've got a very interesting topic. I know that the New Thinking Aloud audience is very curious about egregores, and I've already asked our viewers to watch our previous interview because it's relevant to today's topic, because in that interview, I think you demonstrated quite clearly that in some sense, the ancient Egyptian lion-headed goddess Sekhmet is alive and vital and influencing hundreds, if not thousands, or tens of thousands of people in the world today. Now we can take a deeper look at what does that really mean?
Yeah, I think a good place to start is with the human imagination, because whether these gods are external to us or they are creations of our imagination, they reach us through the human imagination, through our dreams, through our visions, through the way that we capture these experiences in words and in art. And so there have been many who have argued, well, they are merely the creation of the human imagination and nothing else. So we start there, but that's a little difficult. It's almost like saying maybe that music is the creation of the ears. But we can hear it, and we certainly appreciate the music all around us, but it takes a great set of skills and experiences to be able to produce music. And maybe when we say that the human imagination is responsible for the gods, we're oversimplifying. But as we go forward here, we'll see how we'll keep running into the imagination and that question about where that stops and the divine begins.
I think it's very good that you've used music as another metaphor for looking at this. I'm reminded of a quote. I'm not sure where it's from, but I think there's something to it. It goes, when the mode of the music changes, the walls of the city come down.
Yes, absolutely. Plato believed that if you listened to the wrong kind of music, you were threatening the survival of your city.
When I was a graduate student in criminology, we read the work of the great sociologist Emile Durkheim, and he maintained that the gods are projections of the group psyche, the psyche of a nation, for example, And he thought the group psyche is a very real thing. And of course, you can look at the different civilizations on this planet and their gods, and you can see that the gods of any different civilization give you great insights into the nature of that civilization.
Absolutely. And that will also bring us, as we continue, into the subject of egregores, which are very much related to this idea. But I think if we let's go a little deeper into this question as to how that might happen. So, for example, we have had many theories very popular in the late 1890s and on into the 20s that gods were merely heroes who are deified by the aggregation of myths and legends. And then there would be these organized groups of people, priesthoods, who would have strategies and tactics for affecting society and improving their lot in life by manipulating these myths and legends. So an example might be, maybe there was somebody who was just a tremendous farmer in Arcadia. And so eventually when he died, everyone thought of him as a hero. They put up a statue. They tried to remember what he said because it was so important to the health of their city. And eventually people forgot that it was a real human being. And other great farmers' myths became connected to this farmer's myth. And eventually over generations, this blossomed into a full-scale god. And certainly capturing all the details. And that's one of the interesting things when one studies comparative religion is that you do reach a point where almost anything that you read, you begin to recognize the same sinews, the same core in all the religious traditions being expressed in so many wonderfully different ways. And the different expressions are so enlightening. Each of them, because of its uniqueness in time and place that gives it those flavors, becomes something that resonates in as a new way to see this thing that we are trying to understand. And I find that fascinating. Excuse me. So now, you know, some tend to psychologize all this. You know, Freud felt that it was all about wish fulfillment and the gods were projections of the human psyche, especially the internalized parent. And so if you had a parent who was dominating and severe, you were likely to relate to a god who was dominating and severe. But if you had a very loving parent, then you might see God as being loving because you were projecting your father image or your mother image out into the cosmos. And in all the way to the idea that Freud had that mystical experiences such as cosmic consciousness were really just a return to the womb and to the safety of the womb, to the desire to have the feeling that I'm being taken care of in every way. So that we're supposed to have as infants. And so he considered it infantile to have this belief in a God that takes care of everything for you. And all you have to do is have faith and you're okay in the world. However, that is an experience that sometimes intrudes itself upon people who are not simple minded as Freud might have been trying to project there. And who maybe are living even very different kinds of lives, like, for instance, the Apostle Paul, who was someone who was not really living a very religious life and who had this great conversion. And so these conversions can happen to people who don't seem to be in the wish fulfillment category because it's against their will, ultimately, to be changed. But they are forced to change by the power of this divine immanence. There's also the idea of dreams. You know, Freud looked into this too, and Jung will come in here with the archetypes. We wonder, did worship of gods begin in dreams? Because people have dreams of gods. We mentioned Sekhmet, and as is mentioned in the other talk, so many of the people that we interviewed first encountered this goddess in a dream. And then after the interview, there were some people who contacted me and were telling me, hey, Hermes did that. The ancient Greek god contacted me in a dream before I knew who he was. So other gods do that too. And we wonder if in the richness of our dreams, we have these intense experiences that maybe are symbolic and are really working out issues that we have, but they're so intensely powerful that somebody who had that without any psychological knowledge would feel that they had been contacted by a superior force of some kind, and then would try to teach other people and share with other people what this force had taught them. And so dreams could be another place where we see an origin. But the funny thing about that is when we moderns, we kind of glibly dismiss that, because we've learned from Freud and from Jung not to take it literally. But it doesn't mean that there aren't actual beings who are communicating to us through dreams. And in ancient Greece, only one of the cultures where this was a major practice, the gods were constantly talking to people in dreams, giving them warnings, showing them where to go. There were temples that you would go to if you were sick, where you would sleep in order to have dreams that would tell you what to do in order to heal, or what god you had offended and what you must do so the affliction would end. So there is this interesting interface between dreams and the divine that has gone all the way back, I think, to shamanism and to the earliest times of being hunters. And some indigenous people have in their historical records how using dreams to find where prey is, or a wife who has a dream about her husband in trouble out there and then knows where to find him and goes out there with what he needs. So there are people who live in a world where these kinds of dreams are constantly informing their lives. And it's something that the ancient Greeks said about it, which maybe sheds light on this. Actually, it's the Romans, I guess, the Neoplatonists, but they're very influenced by the Greeks, is that when we have those kinds of dreams, when we see someone that we love in trouble so we can help them, or we know where we have to go to attack the enemy, or in order to defend our land, or to get food that we need because over here is where we'll find the herd, this was considered divine vision. Because as human beings, we don't normally have the skill to look into the future or to look far remote and see what's happening somewhere else. And this was considered divine vision. This is how the gods see the world. They can see the future and the past and how the causes become the results. And so when we do omens, or when we have a dream that has a strongly prophetic nature, this was considered the gift of a god sharing divine vision with us. And I think that's a theme that we'll be coming back to too.
Is it a natural human gift, or does it come from elsewhere? It's a question that parapsychologists still haven't begun to answer.
Definitely. I like what Stuart Edward White and the teachings of the invisibles and the unobstructed universe thought about it. He felt that all of these skills were being evolved by human beings, and that ultimately we would all have some sort of telepathic sensitivity, psychic awareness, that these were natural human abilities, but that we had to yet to evolve a society and a way of life that can enable us to fully develop them.
Even the idea of natural, it sort of begs the question as to what is the basis of nature itself? And of course, from my point of view, and many of the guests on this program, and I suspect you would concur, we might say that reality is embedded in consciousness.
Yeah, absolutely. There again, getting back to the unobstructed universe teachings, the idea that the whole purpose of life is to evolve through each step of quality of consciousness by accumulating the most quantity of consciousness that somebody can in that particular quality. So when you become the most individualized, awesome tree that you can possibly be, then you graduate from tree to something else where more consciousness can be accumulated. And that's something that was believed by the indigenous tribes of America and was dismissed by American scholars and European scholars for years as what they called, quote, the pathetic fallacy, right? The idea that everything is conscious, that everything is divine. And yet, by far, most of human history, we've had that belief system that even the stones harbor consciousness, that every form, the color, everything is held together and persistent in time because of the consciousness that is underlying it.
Jean Houston, who was a big influence in my life and to whom we referred in our previous interview on Sekhmet, who played a role, I think, as a sort of a catalyst for the rebirth of Sekhmet in modern times, used to say that we humans are godlings.
Well, that goes back to in our other talk about the hymns of Orpheus, the idea that we are a combination of the titans, of these natural forces of chaos and destructiveness. But on the other hand, we are children of the gods, and that we are of the race of the stars. So the famous saying is that we are of the race of, we're child of earth and of starry heaven. Yeah. And so the starry heaven part of us is divine, because we are literally little bits of the god Dionysius, who was killed by the Titans and consumed. And in that combination, hit by the lightning of Zeus, humanity was born. And so we have this divine potential, but we must, according to the probably Orphic belief in reincarnation, we must go through life after life after life, often in ignorance, not even remembering why we're doing it, in order to achieve enough understanding that we can remember what we really are. And then we become once again a star, and we become part of the creative dance. We actually join the gods in creating instead of simply being part of the creation.
So in that sense, it would seem as if when the psychologists try to minimize the idea of a deity and say, well, it's a psychological projection, it could well be a psychological projection and yet also contain a divine element.
Yes, and then we run into that problem all along because, for example, some of the other ways that, that it's been reduced from the idea of an actual living god to, oh, it's just what William Burroughs thought of as primitive science, that in describing the gods, this was psychology. They didn't have the art of psychology, so they used the gods to try to explain these things. Or we've had many people who theorize, for example, that the gods represent the energies of fertility and renewal, so that the ancient Greeks would do rituals, including singing, to ask the gods to jump into the seeds, or to ask the god to jump into the field, or into the harvest, or into the cattle, into the milk, into the wine, into the young, fertile generation. And like the story of Persephone returning from the underworld, and then spring erupts everywhere. There were many modern 20th century scholars who tried to say that that really all the gods were our way of relating to natural forces that were uncontrollable, to give us the feeling that we could have some kind of control over them. But then how do we explain reports from early colonists in America that there were indigenous shamans who could do things like produce ice cubes in a cup during an extremely hot day, or could change weather patterns and demonstrated it? Now, of course, the colonists thought it was the power of the devil that was giving them that ability, but something was happening there. Another example of how it's dismissed is there was a whole school that was saying that the gods are teaching tools, right? So Zeus and the law of hospitality, the subplot of the Iliad is not, you know, it's not just about the wrath of Achilles. It's about what happened when Paris went and got in love with Helen and then stole her away from Menelaus. And there's a subtext there because it seems that that Helen was coming from a matriarchal tradition, and Paris was from a matriarchal tradition. But unfortunately for Menelaus, he was a patriarchal king who had conquered Sparta and Greece, along with his brother Agamemnon. And so this was almost a resurgence of matriarchy when they stole Helen back to Troy, and then unleash this big war between major patriarchal and matriarchal cultures. And it's an interesting way to look at it, certainly. And you can use the gods to teach. So if you're teaching the Iliad, it's quite a lesson that the city of Troy falls and everyone is slaughtered because Zeus's law of hospitality is broken. You just don't do that to your guest. Or you don't do that to your
to your host.
Yeah, either way.
Run away with his wife.
Exactly. And so the Zeus's law of hospitality is about dealing with strangers or with foreigners and always welcoming them, always giving them food and shelter and trusting them. And in turn, they must act in a way worthy of trust. And so we can see that these are useful teaching tools. And some people have said, well, no, this was just a clever way to describe these things and to teach people how to behave in a more civilized fashion. You could also use the gods in the other way of saying, you know, well, look what happened when Zeus got sexually involved with so-and-so, and it made Hera angry, and then the gods got in a big fight. So all of these were lessons, in a way, about how to live in a society. And also that relates to controlling cultures through the fear of the divine, right? So using imagination and words to force someone to behave. And I often think it must have come somehow from, you know, you have someone who just represents brute force and aggression, just the peak of patriarchy, might is right. And how do you overcome that? And some brilliant imaginative priest of some kind came up with eternal damnation that existed before Christianity, although they really reveled in it. And you could really use that on the imagination of a conqueror. You could say, well, you may think you're so great down here being king, but you know there's a greater king than you, and you're headed down there to burn for all the things that you've done. And if you capture that conqueror's imagination, there will be a big change. And there were examples of this in history. So that makes it a useful tool. But to such a degree, it actually can run away with the culture. And I love this quote from the indigenous American poet activist John Trudell, an amazing human being. He thought that fear was the central pillar of Western religion. He did an interview with Tamara once, and in it he said, quote, apocalyptic propaganda is the basis of Western religion. It's a control mechanism by instilling fear. You instill the fear so people won't think clearly. Everything is there to disrupt the creative intelligence so it doesn't flow with clarity and coherence. So, fearing the apocalyptic is a mining tool that they've been using ever since they came up with the concept of the male dominator god. End quote. So here's this concept that fear just has run away with the Western religions. And really what it is a hierarchy, an autocracy that's very useful for controlling large societies through fear. And we can see how this affects and infects religion. So look at ancient Rome or ancient Egypt. And what you'll see is, especially with the Romans, they'll go conquer somewhere and then they see the gods of the place. That's a good god. We like that god. That god reminds me of our god so-and-so. And that god winds up in the pantheon in Rome because they see this same thing. It's, you know, Hermes is Thoth. So the Greek god, the Egyptian god, the Mercury, our god, is obviously the same as those two. So they would even sometimes hyphenate them, right? They would, you know, Hermes, Thoth, Mercury. And it was very accepting, in a sense, of other people's beliefs, understanding that there can be other gods and that they're a way of seeing the divine that's valuable. But as this fear mechanism, really strongly emphasized by monotheists, became a dominant force in culture, we got into this, my god is God, and your gods are demons. Your gods are imposters. And this is such an excellent way to wage war because you can't see the humanity in the other person. So instead of the colonists in America saying to the shaman, how did you make an ice cube in the middle of summer out of just water? What? No, they didn't do that because that was the power of the devil. I don't want to know how to do that. What a shame. Nobody asked. And now it's a lot of these arts are lost because these shamanistic traditions were so badly damaged by disease and warfare and by forced conversions to Christianity and such. So this idea that only our God is right and that everything else is evil or demonic, I think is one of the biggest problems afflicting the world today. Because it puts the human race, which is in a situation today where we need a lot of compassion and tolerance and cooperation, into this, I have to win. Because if I don't win, it's all going to be destroyed. I recently saw a strange quote from Elon Musk, and you never know if the guy's kidding or if he's high on ketamine or whatever, but he said that he thought that unless people embrace Christianity again, it would die off and there wouldn't be any goodness or ethics left in society. Which is just, there's so many things wrong with that statement. The idea that Christianity is the only source of ethics to begin with, or the idea that one must be religious to be ethical and to be a good person, because there are wonderfully ethical and good atheists out there as well. But this idea infects so many people, and it makes you look at something like, millions upon millions of people would just look at Sekhmet with her bare breasts and her lion head and just think, that's a demon. That's got to be some kind of satanic invention. But she actually is this very deep symbolism from ancient Egypt about things like justice and the power of women and the need to defend the delicate balance of life. Because unless you defend that delicate balance of life, life turns ugly. Bad things start happening to people. So a simple example, if you forget what the Egyptians and the Romans knew about cats, which is they're great for keeping down rodents and other disease-carrying creatures, then you have a certain level of protection. But if you decide that cats are creatures of witches and the devil, and you kill all the cats and no one's killing the rats, you get the bubonic plague in Europe 1,000 years later, after the more than 1,000 years after the Egyptians already understood and the Romans understood. And one of the funny things about the Romans, you know, is that they brought cats everywhere. And so they were not just bringing their roads and their aqueducts, but they were carrying cats along with them and bringing them to societies that didn't know them, because they were great for protecting granaries and for keeping rat population down. And they had noticed that this was important. So I believe that this believing that others are worshiping false or evil entities blinds humanity and causes a lot of unnecessary suffering.
Jane Houston used to suggest that the polytheistic religions had more tolerance for the human psyche itself. That the human psyche is polytheistic. Even the monotheistic Hebrew Kabbalists understood this with the 10 emanations that they describe of the divine. It's like a whole pantheon within the human psyche.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to get into now looking at, so let's look now at the gods themselves as. Okay. So what are we talking about here? And I want to start with the wheel of life, right? The Bhava Chakra, the Buddha's six realms of reincarnation. There's an interesting idea there. So those six realms, for those who may not know them, are hell, hungry ghosts, animals, human beings, the demigods or asuras, and the gods. We can, depending on our behavior in life, be incarnated into any of these places as any of these beings. And the gods are just like us in that their karma eventually burns up. And they live this wonderful life according to this particular perspective. They're beautiful, they're wise, they have incredibly long lives, they live in unspeakable splendor. They don't care too much about human beings, about the beings of the other realms in this idea. They're very self-absorbed. But eventually, one of them will show some sign of age or sickness, and he is immediately shunned by all the other gods who don't want to be reminded that their karma will someday burn up. And the gods try to say, no, this god did something wrong. That's what happened. This won't happen to me. I'll be this forever. It also reminds me of the famous story of the boy who confronted the proud king of the gods, Indra. Yes. And this boy was actually the great destroyer god Shiva in disguise. And Indra had gotten kind of out of control with his bureaucratic self-infatuation and was visited in order to be restored to balance. And as he tried to understand why he found the presence of this kid who looked like a beggar child from the lowest case so frightening, the comment the child made was, wow, you know, this is the nicest palace that all the kings of the gods, of all of them, this is the best. Well, Indra doesn't like the sound of that. What do you mean, the other kings of the gods? I'm the only king of the gods. Right then, long trail of ants, big, wide, long trail of ants is crossing the altar room. That's a bad thing anyway. I mean, bad omen. How did that happen? Well, the kid points at them and he says, every single one of those ants was once a king of the gods. In the vast timelessness of space, every possibility finds its reality. And of course, Indra is quite shaken by this revelation that he could wind up being an ant someday. But this idea that the gods are not these immortals who have these endless lifespans and who control every aspect of creation, but that they too are just beings higher up on the ladder of consciousness, and their actions also dictate their futures. And it's possible for them to fall all the way down and have to relearn themselves. So I just thought that was an interesting idea to share, because it gives a different perspective on it. And we have other ways of kind of undermining the immortality of the gods. So there are some who claim that the gods are aliens, that they're a distant memory of alien visitation. This is also a theory about Sekhmet. There's in right now a current theory that she is on the planet as a general for an alien race, trying to defend we poor ignorant humans from predator races that are here exploiting us. And that all the myth around the so-called goddess Sekhmet is just a misunderstanding of alien technology. Or that it's a distant memory of Atlantis is one that is commonly said, that these characters were famous kings and members of society in Atlantis, and that their stories were kept by civilizations and developed and embroidered upon, but all they are is very distant memories of the past. We also hear that they are interdimensional beings. So they could be manipulative. We don't know what they are. They're like, just like an alien. Why are they here? What is the motivation? Why have they interacted with humanity for so long? And then there's the idea that they are fake projections of an insidious plot to enslave the human psyche, right? The mind parasites, that you create these gods in order to suck up people's suffering and faith and anger. So instead of acting to protect themselves or to get a tyrant off the throne, they simply pray to the gods. And that has gone so far that even one of my mentors, a scholar by the name of Kenneth Achety, among several other scholars, did research suggesting that Jesus was an invention of the Romans, of the Augustine era, to control people, because they realized that it was more efficient for them to control people through religion than it was through the legions, which were very expensive. And by creating this religion that told people to give Caesar what Caesar wanted and to just, you know, turn the other cheek, they were making it way easier to run the empire. It was a very interesting theory.
Well, the Emperor Constantine, who was largely responsible for converting the pagan Romans to Christianity, felt that if he's going to rule this large empire, there needs to be one religion. And as I recall, he made a point of converting himself to Christianity, but only right before his death, so that he could continue to commit sins right up until his conversion.
Yes, one of the convenient aspects of Christianity that has been so abused, that the idea that I actually knew someone who felt that they were a devout Christian, but who were into all the sins that they could get together, and just thought it was the greatest deal in the world. As long as I confess before I die, I'm good. And I never understood that. Karma made more sense to me. I don't think you get away with it. I don't think it's quite the way you think it is. But that is something that's been very popular, and it was part of the reason for the Protestant Revolution, because of the Catholic sale of indulgences. You could do horrible things and then give the church a nice gift, and they would tell you to say some Hail Marys and you were okay. Your soul was saved. It was a very tricky kind of approach to ethics.
Buddhism is an interesting case in point, because scholars will say Buddhists are essentially atheists. They don't believe in any self, a god or a human, having a permanent self, that all things are transitory. What they seem to suggest is more permanent is a philosophical idea of awakening. And the Buddha was once asked, as I recall, are you a god? And he said, no, I'm awake.
Yes, exactly.
And yet they acknowledge deities.
Yes, and they the deities are even like the wrathful deities who are turned into defenders of the faith. And then when you get into we're going to talk about words as we continue, but it's interesting because if you get into something like the Flower Adornment Sutra, and you're listing all these fantastic Buddhas, these descriptions of them, just a universes upon universes filled with Buddhas of the most gorgeous descriptions. Is it that different from gods, from descriptions of gods, now they're Buddhas, or Catholic saints? We have these different words that are describing very similar things. But before we go there, I think it's time to dive into egregores, because we're talking about ways to kind of undermine the gods, the idea of the gods. And this is one that's quite popular these days. And so I want to give a little history about this idea and how it's changed over time. The idea is that the gods are egregores, they're the collective projection of groups. So from this point of view, there are occultists who are quite concerned about the reawakening of Sekhmet. They see it as this collective thought form that from ancient times that was this apocalyptic goddess of war, and people are waking her up, and that's a bad thing because it's not a god. It's the power of human thought congealed by all the energy and the statues that were made and the priests that served the statues, and this can be reawakened. And so it was reawakened by Robert Masters and by others. And so from their point of view, this is not Sekhmet, the goddess of justice, the defender of the balance of life. This is a moralist thought form that just wants more power for itself and will manipulate in all the ways that a god could, dreams, synchronicities, anything you can imagine. So the ancient Greek word is egregoros, which means ever awake or ever watchful. And in the Book of Enoch, the egregores are described as these kind of angel-like creatures who married the daughters of men. Sometimes they were called the most illustrious angels. The sin of the watchers was that they chose to descend. They wanted to be in the material world. They wanted to possess the daughters of men. And from this forbidden intercourse, giants were born, the Nephilim, or Nephilim, some people pronounce them. And so this Enochian branch of the tree of Western esotericism attempted to communicate with the watchers by means of ritual, scrying, mediumship. John Dee believed he was communicating with them. And the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn was deeply interested in all things Enochian and in trying to establish communication with these angels. There was kind of the idea that, well, are they fallen angels, or are they like Prometheus? Did they fall because they fell in love with humanity and they wanted to bring their knowledge and their power into humanity? Around the 1800s, a French novel was written in the Russian Empire by a Polish author, Count Potocki, which referred to the egregore as he called it, quote, the most illustrious of fallen angels, end quote. And this was suggesting that you know, the highest angels looked down upon women, the creation of God, and thought that they were just so beautiful and spectacular that they were willing to give up their angelic lives to come and be trapped in the material world. As Mark Stavish pointed out in his book on egregores, the magus of mid-19th century Paris, Eliphas Levi, identified the biblical watchers with the egregores. He claimed that they were quote unquote terrible beings who had once been angels, and they were sent to watch over humanity, lusted after human females, became the fathers of the giants, and they would quote crush us without pity because they are unaware of our existence, unquote. He compared them to natural laws, like physical laws of the world, that things just happen and they don't care if you're there or not. And Rene Guénon said that Eliphas Levi was responsible for an elaboration of this definition, that he took this ancient occult idea that words are creative, thoughts are creative, and he evolved it into the belief that what we speak, especially in groups and especially when it's very intense and ritualized, creates these autonomous beings who can influence our lives and the lives of others. So getting back to the idea that each nation, for instance, has its own egregore, or Freemasonry, or different kinds of Freemasonry have different kinds of egregore. So there's one type of Freemasonry where women are absolutely out, and that egregore obviously is not comfortable with women. And there are ones where women are allowed to be initiated, and so that egregore thinks women are fine. And there's also the idea that these any kind of repeated emotionally charged expressions, conversations, toxic mantras of inner thought, especially when they're experienced within groups, they take on a life of their own. And they're like the evils released from Pandora's box, the flocking to afflict us, right? To find victims whom they can turn to their needs, which is attention and increased power for themselves. In 1934, the traditionalist philosopher Julius Evola, in his book Revolt Against the Modern World, wrote of an elite of guardians of high attainment who keep spiritual traditions alive. He said, quote, those who are awake, whom in Greek are called the egregoroi, end quote. What I find interesting about that is it's similar to Manly Hall's idea of secret elites of masters guiding human destiny, which is weird because you could not get any more different than Evola and Manly Hall. And yet they both felt that there were these groups that were secretly guiding, you know, humans of high attainment, making sure that the traditions remained alive and pure, or as pure as they could be. The egregore thing really got a big punch in 1967 from this anonymous book that was published called Meditations on the Tarot, A Journey into Christian Hermeticism. Very Catholic. Its perspective was that egregores are demons engendered by the collective will and imagination of nations, almost like the devil lending humans power to create these evil presences. And so the Antichrist was described by this author as, quote, an egregore, an artificial being who owes his existence to collective generation from below, unquote. So this concept of egregores even evolved further with occultists experimenting with creating egregores as magical entities that would serve them, that would do their bidding the way demons obeyed Solomon in the Testament of Solomon, or the Tibetan idea of tulpas, thought forms that practitioners deliberately materialize through powerful concentration and ritual work. And so you can put these tulpas to work for you to accomplish certain goals that you want, or to protect you. And there are magicians today who are working on building these egregores that they use in order to further their own practices. So there's a lot to unpack in all of this. The idea that humans have the power of creating by thinking, which is always makes me think of not just the word in the Bible, but a much earlier version of that with the ancient Egyptian god Ptah, who created the world with his words and voice and thoughts. And so this idea that by thinking or speaking that we can create, I mean, it certainly holds some truth, right? Because by communicating, we can change the world. We can change ourselves. And we see examples of that every day when things change rapidly because they are communicated and people come together behind an idea. But I have to say, just from my point of view, and this is just me, because I wouldn't ever say, no, there's no such thing, because I find all of these fascinating. But I will point out that the idea that we fill space with the teeming creations of a lifetime of thoughts, and this is multiplied by billions of humans alive at the same time as we are, and all the thought forms of all the humans that were here before, apparently all trying to survive and attract our attention, it gets really complicated. And maybe unnecessarily so. And I always kind of see Occam's razor off in the distance saying, it's too complicated. The simple description, the simple explanation will suffice. But there are things that are good, I think, about this, because it's undeniable that some of the people who accept the existence of egregores as fact have benefited from paying attention to the insidious ways that the personas of charismatic leaders and organizations can shape choices and behaviors of the people who commit to follow them. It encourages individuality, and that's a virtue, and it warns people to be skeptical of groupthink, which is also very important, and to keep their thought gardens weeded, not just go with the flow. But a frequent complaint about the occult is that it populates the invisible with fearful phantasms to be avoided or placated. And there's so many serious problems to deal with right in front of us right now in the world. So I feel just personally that if one is engaged too deeply with these invisible, fearful phantasms, then we're missing the real fearful situations that need all the human attention and ingenuity and compassion and compromise and cooperation that we can bring to it. And of course, that's been a criticism of religion all along, that it can make people passive and they become involved with ideas about things that aren't really right in front of them, and things that need to be fixed right in front of them get ignored as a result. And you get the Dark Ages, when all these amazing things that the Romans understood, for example, are forgotten for many generations. The other thing that's interesting to me about egregores is the way it is blended with spiritualist and theosophist ideas about what they call astral shells. These astral shells that are persistent after death, and they seek to survive by taking over people. So the example that I would give, that I personally witnessed growing up in Los Angeles, was several generations of faux Jim Morrisons, for example, who used to haunt the LA club scene, and of whom I was one briefly. And they were said to have been overtaken by Morrison's astral shell. So there was always a Morrison with the leather pants and the white wedding dress, Mexican wedding shirt. There's always a Morrison with the beard, the heavy Morrison for the later years. There was always, you know, and then different ones for each generation would pop up. And they thought that they were being original, that they were expressing the inspiration that Morrison gave them. But really, they were just kind of this weird reflection, an imitation of it. And they would attract people, girlfriends, to be like Jim's girlfriend, or somebody wanted to be like Ray Manzarek, would play keyboards. And they would have their careers, which were obviously short because people knew that they were just imitating the Doors and they weren't as good. But people would, and I heard people describe this as possession by astral shells, that Jim Morrison's persona, the drunken, fornicating Dionysian persona that was still being idolized by and sexualized and everything by fans, was roaming the streets of L.A. looking for suckers like me to pretend to be Jim so that it could have these experiences again. I thought that was an interesting development of the whole egregore thing.
It reminds me of my mother, who was an actress, and her greatest role was playing Blanche DuBois, the heroine of Streetcar Named Desire. And after she, it was a brilliant performance, but Blanche never left her after that. After there was always a little bit of Blanche in my dear mother after that occasion. And it, I suppose you could say astral. Well, of course, Blanche was never a real human being, more like an egregore.
Right, exactly. It reminds me of something that happened with Andy Griffith, when he did this amazing acting that he did in Face in the Crowd, a movie that I recommend to everybody, especially right now, because, wow, this is it speak to politics and media. But Andy Griffith, apparently, when he was playing this character, who's this really bold, aggressive, nasty guy, he would bring it home. Like he was immersed in the character and was, in a sense, possessed by the character until his wife told him in no uncertain terms, either you come home as you and not with this guy, or you can go live somewhere else while you're doing this movie. And so he toned it down when he came home. But this can happen, this kind of possession by this. I think he was probably, having played so many good guys, you know, nice American guy, he suddenly was playing this charismatic monster, and he must have loved it, the freedom and the power that he was experiencing. And they can possess you. And I think that happens to a lot of musicians who they have their success and they confuse themselves with how they're being seen. And this was something that, I don't know why I was this, I guess I was just so contrary, but when I was in a successful band when I was a kid, which what we discussed wasn't a very positive band, whenever I had groupies approaching me, I was disgusted because I felt like, come on, you know, like you wouldn't care if I was some other dude in another band, you know, this is just you working out your thing. And, but I saw many young musicians, friends of mine even, who, as they began to achieve success, became possessed by their persona and tried to be that rock star that was, you know, hitting 10 girls a day and all these things, and would have terrible physical breakdowns, even as young men, as a result, because they couldn't do all the drugs and all the sex and all the things that they wanted to do. And they soon discovered how human they were and that there were parts of themselves that had never really bought in to this persona. So, and I think some people never get to wake up from it because they perish while they're in the persona. And that's also an interesting question about what happens when you're not yourself when you cross over.
Well, this brings us to the topic of archetypes.
Yes, very much so.
I did several interviews, for example, with Gene Shinoda Bolen, who wrote the book, two books, Gods in Every Man and Goddesses in Every Woman. And she felt that these deities are essentially Jungian archetypes, and the danger is that we can become possessed by them unwittingly, and it can lead to bad things for people.
Yes, the inflation of the ego and the shadow seizing control over all the other aspects of the psyche, and yeah, definitely, and we can see how it plays out in society when people, again, try to live this archetypal presence without humility. They feel that they are the only definition of what is right or what should happen. And that's typical of that kind of ego inflation. So archetypes, particularly the Jungian view, is somewhat related to Plato's forms, but very different in the sense that Plato's forms were the living archetypes and we're the shadows. So Plato's archetypes are the creative forces of the universe, and we are simply the reflections of the combinations of them. Jung takes us into a different place where we have the collective experience and the collective unconscious of humanity having experiences over and over and over again over all the millennia of our development. And that some of these experiences are so common to us and so powerful that they become archetypes. And so a god is an archetype of certain types of human beings, for example, certain aspects of nature. And they're so powerful because they represent over and over again experiences that human beings have had in relation to these areas of life. And the things that have most influenced humanity distilled into images, I think, is one way to look at it. And that takes us back to the idea of the gods as teaching tools and such. It's part of this ladder of civilization that we're collectively climbing. This is interesting to me because I like to compare it to theurgy, the ancient Neoplatonic art of reuniting with the divine. And I think of it as respecting the liminal boundary between the personal and the sacred. And so, which is it? You know, and it, to the Jungians, this is a psychological realm where we must carefully navigate this process of individuation so that we can become truly unique individuals and be the most that we can be as ourselves. And so in that sense, the archetypes can be made to serve us, to help us to understand what our place is in society, who we are, and our depths. Theurgy is saying that the gods are real and that we are the ones who are sort of this unconsciousness. And so we use ritual and practice in order to make of ourselves the living images, as we discussed in our last talk about Sekhmet, of the gods. One of the descriptions from a Tibetan school, which very similar ideas, is that we must be like a bamboo, hollow in the middle, and so the gods can fill us. And this idea of theurgy is that we become so attuned to the gods that we actually can share in their divine vision and regain some of our own divinity, regain ourselves. And it's interesting to me that Jung is attempting to achieve the same thing in a different vocabulary, the ultimate individuation of a human being. So in theurgy, that means that we reconnect with our divine core. And in Jung, it means that we sort of rise above all of the, I would call them, unconscious limitations that we have learned. And through the guidance of the archetypes and intelligent navigation of them, we can be liberated from those things and be truly ourselves, living an authentic life. They're so similar to me. I mean, they're not certainly not the same thing, but you wonder, you know, is this just words? And we're going to get into that right now. But before we do that, we got to mention Madame Blavatsky, because she comes in here and throws a wrench into the whole thing, because she says the gods are just the reflections of our own higher selves. She says there is no way that you with your monkey brain are going to be able to apprehend gods. That's just way out of our league. What we're seeing when we experience gods, the bright light, the cosmic consciousness, the incredible mercy and grace, is the higher self. The qualities with which cultures have invested their gods are merely symbols of the powers of the higher soul in The Secret of the Golden Flower. And so let's look at that for a moment. You know, what kind of powers do gods have? Well, gods know all. Well, supposedly our higher souls also see the past, they see the future, they understand the big picture of everything that's going on, and they are unlimited by time or space. The gods are supposed to be able to do incredible acts of healing. Well, all through the history of metaphysics, we hear that when we attune to the soul, we can heal ourselves. That when the higher soul is able to fully saturate the physical body with its harmony, then all the sicknesses, even aging, are dealt with and are put away and postponed. And so we have this idea that even, you know, if you're looking at Zeus, well, that's somebody's higher self. That's your higher soul symbolized there. Very interesting idea, I think. There certainly seems to be some truth to the resemblances between the powers of the gods. But if we say that we have a divine inheritance, that also explains it. So as you know, we are godlings, and that's why we get flashes of this. It isn't simply that's just our own higher self and there aren't any gods. But Blavatsky had a very interesting viewpoint there. I like to turn to, in the midst of all this, to turn to Wittgenstein, because he really reminds us that when we detach words from the things that they designate, the mind starts to play tricks on us. So you've got time, right? Time is very useful. I can see what time it is, what time we're supposed to meet. We know what time to avoid driving in traffic, all that stuff. Nobody has any questions about that time. But now let's take it away from that and just talk about time. What is time? What made time? Is time a god? And now off we go into this world where Wittgenstein felt, now you're missing the whole boat. Like now you're not even living life. You're not authentically in your life in the moment. You're out here in your brain in these airy abstractions. And so we take these words and we mistake them for the thing that they are. And this is a callback to the idea that my God is God and your gods are demons, right? My God is the only God with the right name. And your God, who may be similar to my God, but has a different name, is clearly evil. It got so severe that even versions of Jesus in Christianity were attacked by other schools of Christianity as not being the right Jesus or the right way to think of Jesus. It's interesting that the Hebrews used four letters, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. It was not only that you were forbidden to speak the holy name, but it was reminding us that if you try to capture it in words or images, you're only distracting from this ever confounding and overwhelming reality of the divine presence. It's too much to put into words. And a similar thing, although it's not said about gods, is said by the Chinese in the great Tao Te Ching, when it says that the Tao that can be described or can be put into words is not the Tao. It escapes words. And the minute that you attempt to impress it into something, you lose the Tao. You're no longer in the moment. And so you're no longer in the divine presence of this current moment. And so all of these words, egregore, God, archetype, all of these different ways of viewing the gods, fertility, teaching tools, hero cults, are just different ways of looking at something that remains fundamentally mysterious and inexplicable. So I like to turn at this point to, I think, what is one of the most useful perspectives in understanding all of this, which came from Robert Anton Wilson. And that's the idea of reality tunnels. He said that most of us are born into a reality tunnel that's shared by our family, our school, our nation, our religion. He said most people experience more than one reality tunnel during a lifetime. So an example, a really good example, is the reality tunnels of many of the boys who were growing up Christian in the Midwest in the early 1960s were radically changed by rock music and psychedelics. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in the tunnel that they were born into, the government was 100% to be trusted and obeyed. Premarital sex was 100% bad. Cannabis was a dangerous destroyer of morals. And then in the new tunnel, you could never trust the government. Premarital sex was great and mandatory almost, and cannabis was a sacred substance, or at least something that was really lots of fun. And you can see there that this vivid switch into a different reality tunnel. Wilson himself illustrated the concept once by referring to the differences between generations. So there was a generation that sexualized high heels and hotel bedrooms and cocktails. But their kids, they like moccasins and sleeping bags, and they like to smoke weed. But it's the same continuance of the species necessity that's being served. It's just that there's different reality tunnels providing these details for us. He suggested in a very revolutionary way, along with his buddy Tim Leary, that in the future, human beings would be able to navigate these reality tunnels by choice rather than chance. And I think that we're really seeing this in the world today, where people are exploring religion that way. I know a number of people who, you know, first they explored paganism and witchcraft, and then they went into a more hermetic, esoteric kind of thing. And then they went into Christianity, which they came from originally, and tried a different kind of Christianity. And so they're going into these different reality tunnels, sampling things and taking from each tunnel experiences that help them to live a better life. And Wilson said that he advised us to play with trying on different reality tunnels, to deliberately take them on and see what they're like. And I think that's a great exercise that it kind of loosens up our we have a tendency to get kind of stuck into ways of doing things. And this reminds us of how creative life can be.
Another way of thinking of the reality tunnel is something of a consensus trance. And By switching reality tunnels, we break out of the trance. We may fall into yet a different trance, but at least we know we have the capability, should we choose, to break out of that one.
Yeah, it's such a powerful tool to have at one's disposal, to know that you can do that and that the world will accommodate it. But ultimately, each of us has to find our own approach. No one can do it for us. We have to kind of go within and then experience our life without, and have the courage to see what's there. So, for example, in my case, being raised by atheists, even when I worked for Manly Hall, I could greatly admire the gods and all the art and everything. I could not have experiences of any kind of divine grace or presence, or I didn't understand really what it meant. I understood it intellectually, but it was not in my experience. And for me, there were several gods, but especially Sekhmet, who were intrusively present in my life. And it opened up for me the ability to actually feel those things, to feel the grace of a deity, to feel the appreciation and the love when something so overpoweringly grand enters your life and changes everything. And so I don't think that could have happened had I stayed in that intellectual state, because the siege that the gods put on me was a long one. I was so defensive in my intellect that I could be dealing with the hymns of Orpheus, but I couldn't feel it. I couldn't actually have this, what it was intended to create in a human being. And now I do have that, and I see how much more infinitely rich life is when you have access to those feelings and to that kind of assistance in the world. And so then you begin to feel that you have this vast collaboration going on. The Neoplatonist philosopher Iamblichus said, quote, "All things are full of gods," unquote. This is because, he explains, all things are linked to the primal causes and to the ultimate source of creation. And so the light of divine consciousness is everywhere, always giving all worlds their existence. This is like the achievement of awareness of the Buddha land in Buddhism, when you suddenly see this world reflected in all its glory and wisdom and beauty as the jewel net of Indra, where each jewel reflects every other jewel, and yet there are no jewels. So these, I think, are all ways to help us to get out of the straitjacket of words and back to the experiences that seem to cluster around these divinities, whatever they are. So what my studies have led me to is cherish the different words, the different visions of the divine. They're all wonderful. And it's amazing that we have access to all of them at this point in history. It's a gift that was not available to only but a few, and not to this extent ever. And don't get hung up on the differences. All the things that we talked about in this talk are all pointing at something, something of great importance to humanity. History is filled with it, with art and literary descriptions and societies that were put together so that other people could find out about it. This has been a great human endeavor throughout the existence of humanity to understand the mysteries of the divine and the spiritual. The best way for us to do that is to let ourselves learn and be taught, and not become, I like to use the word, addicted to a certain point of view, especially if that point of view is so divisive, and especially if it dismisses all other points of view as being irrelevant or inferior or even evil. That, I think, is a shadow of humanity that needs a lot of healing. And so I hope that in this discussion, we've helped people to see how beautiful all of these different ideas are, how each of them has some interesting thing to say about human nature and human psychology and about the nature of life in the world. And that rather than being afraid of difference in these areas of life. We can cherish them and explore them, and we can stay humble and open to being in a sort of service to whatever this mystery is. Is you know it when it's in your life and you experience the things that you know, it comes back to by their fruit ye shall judge them. And this is my response to people who, for example, say, well, Sekhmet is an egregore who's very dangerous and destructive. I say, well, I've interviewed so many people whose lives have been so beautifully transformed by whatever this is that we're calling Sekhmet, that I have to feel a sense of awe before this, because it is something that is bringing so much goodness to people's lives. And if that is the steady kind of influence, then we can see that something's happening here that's worthwhile. And almost all religions have had this. Even, and most people today know that Satanism isn't, you know, what people used to think it is. Well, there are many people today who still think it's that. But even Satanism, for example, it can be a beautiful way to view the world for people who really need to liberate themselves from the Catholic kind of, or, you know, the Christian kind of viewpoint, that taught them to be afraid of the body or to hate pleasure, or, that this world is a snare. It was healthy to have a different form of the religion show up saying, no, it's good to have pleasure. And so exploring all of these ideas, we can find out so much about ourselves. And I think that they all ultimately, when we take the word, we peel the word off it, right? So we say, peel away the word archetype, peel away the word egregore, peel away the word God. There's something there that's greater than all those words.
Ronnie Pontiac, what a joy to be with you once again. I know we've shared a lot of words with each other and with the New Thinking Aloud audience. I think of these words as sort of the language of the divine. And it's good to know the language, even if it doesn't lead to any final conclusion or result. And I think you've demonstrated that perfectly. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Oh, thank you for the honor of talking with you.
And for those of you listening or watching, thank you for being with us, because you are the reason that we are here.
Three in the New Thinking Aloud dialogue series is UFOs and UAP, Are We Really Alone? Now available on Amazon.
You can now download a PDF copy or order a beautiful printed copy of Issue 6 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.